Thomas Jefferson's anger over John Marshall's behavior at the Burr trial lashed him into a fury, exceeded only by the animus he had nursed against Alexander Hamilton in the 1790s. Did any candid man in the U.S., asked Jefferson, not believe that Burr was as guilty as sin? Jefferson's rage at Marshall was all the more peculiar, since Marshall and Jefferson both were Virginians, both had attended the College of William and Mary, and both had sat at the feet of George Wythe as a legal mentor. And it was Jefferson who signed the license that admitted Marshall to practice law in his native Fauquier County in 1780. They were even related. Both of their fathers had married Randolphs. The one experience they did not share, though, was service in the Continental Army. Thomas Jefferson never donned a uniform in his life. But in 1777, John Marshall enlisted in the 11th Virginia, one of the regular units of the Continental Army, and commanded by the celebrated frontier rifleman Daniel Morgan. And Marshall was commissioned as a lieutenant. He fought his first battle at the Brandywine in September of 1777, and then endured the dreary winter encampment at Valley Forge. "They all lived in huts," remembered one of his messmates, the inaptly named Philip Slaughter. "Although the snow was up to their knees and not one soldier in five had a blanket, the country people used to bring them supplies which, though far from inviting, were bought and consumed with great eagerness. The Dutch women," that's not literally Dutch, it's a corruption of German, Deutsch, German women, German immigrants, "might frequently be seen riding into camp seated on great bags, which contained one or two bushels each of apple pies, baked so hard that they could be thrown across the room without being the worse for it." Marshall survived the winter of continental discontent and brought out of it a lesson which stayed with him as long as he lived, that the soldiers who were making a revolution were making it to create not just a loose-jointed Confederacy, but a new nation, and doing it as an army of men thrown together from all the states as Americans, and commanded by one general whom they revered above all, George Washington. I had grown up at a time when the love of the Union and the resistance to the claims of Great Britain were the inseparable inmates of the same bosom, Marshall told his associate Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story. When patriotism and a strong fellow feeling with our suffering fellow citizens of Boston were identical, when the maxim, "United we stand, divided we fall," was the maxim of every Orthodox American. And I had imbibed these sentiments so thoroughly that they constituted a part of my being. I carried them with me into the army, where I found myself associated with brave men from different states who were risking life and everything valuable in a common cause believed by all to be most precious, and where I was confirmed in the habit of considering America as my country and Congress as my government. It was at Valley Forge that Marshall also got his first taste of the law. On February 5th, 1778, Marshall was detailed to assist the judge advocate of the army, in other words, the officer handling all the army's internal court-martial and punishment affairs, as a deputy judge advocate in the Army of the United States. He evidently had the sort of mind that feasts on the fine distinctions of law and arbitration. Burgess Ball, the lieutenant colonel of the 9th Virginia, remembered Marshall as not only brave, but signally intelligent. Indeed, all those who intimately knew him affirmed that his capacity was held in such estimation by many of his brother officers that in many disputes of a certain description, and clearly he means their challenges to duels, he was constantly chosen arbiter, and that officers, irritated by differences or animated by debate, often submitted the contested points to his judgment which, being given in writing, and accompanied, as it commonly was, by sound reasons in support of his decision, obtained general acquiescence. In 1779, Marshall was sent home on recruiting duty. It did not impose many actual demands on Marshall, so he put himself under the tutelage of George Wythe at William & Mary for a crash course in legal studies. At the end of actual campaigning at Yorktown in 1781, Marshall resigned his commission and took up law practice in Richmond. A year later, he won a seat in the Virginia legislature, and sitting there opened Marshall's eyes to the real cause of the suffering of the Continentals at Valley Forge. While the soldiers of the Revolution suffered, gaseous politicians, who declined any personal exertions of their own, exhaled platitude-laden speeches in state assemblies about the glories of liberty, and then gutted every initiative on the national level for victory. "My immediate entrance into the state legislature," he later told Joseph Story, "opened to my view the causes which had been chiefly instrumental in augmenting those sufferings. And the general tendency of state politics convinced me that no safe and permanent remedy could be found but in a more efficient and better organized general government." Especially in the South, the great planters put their private animosities and little interests and passions at the head of the state legislature's agendas while doing nothing to expedite and facilitate the business of recovering debts and compelling a strict compliance with contracts, much less the larger task of establishing on the firm basis of certainty the independence of America. So, when Patrick Henry tried to forestall the calling of a Virginia state ratifying convention for the new Constitution, Marshall dared him with a counter-resolution in the legislature that the new Constitution should be laid before them for their free and ample discussion, and won. Elected to the ratifying convention, he boldly bearded Patrick Henry in his own den, the supporters of the Constitution, and not the anti-Federalists like Henry and George Mason, claimed the title of being sincere friends of liberty and the rights of mankind. "What are the favorite maxims of democracy? A strict observance of justice and public faith, and a steady adherence to virtue. These, sir, are the principles of good government. No mischief, no misfortune ought to deter us from a strict observance of justice and public faith. Would to heaven that these principles had been observed under the present government. Had this been the case, the friends of liberty would not be so willing now to part with it." This astonished Patrick Henry, who thought that what Marshall was advocating was a revolution as radical as that which separated us from Great Britain. But it delighted James Madison, who thought Marshall had shown a great deal of ability in the ratifying convention. It was not that Marshall was an eloquent orator. One observer thought his voice was dry and hard. His attitude in his most effective orations was often extremely awkward, as it was not unusual for him to stand with his left foot in advance, while all his gestures proceeded from his right arm and consisted merely in a vehement, perpendicular swing of it. It was the force of Marshall's reasoning which carried the day. And in the mid-1790s, he had become a principal figure in Virginia Federalism. Washington offered him the post of Attorney General in 1795. Adams tagged him as one of the three XYZ commissioners in 1797, where, as Jefferson complained, the XYZ dish was cooked up by Marshall to make the French government look like swindlers. And then as Adams Secretary of State. And when Oliver Ellsworth resigned as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court on September 30th, 1800, Adams nominated Marshall as his replacement. There was some question as to exactly what kind of honor this was. John Jay, sitting as the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court from 1790 to 1795, wrote opinions on only 4 cases in that capacity. No wonder Jay confessed that I left the bench perfectly convinced that under a system so defective, it would not obtain the energy, weight, and dignity which are essential, nor acquire the public confidence and respect which, as the last resort of the justice of the nation, it should possess. Part of Jay's frustration was rooted in the brevity and vagueness with which the Constitution describes the Supreme Court. But part of it was also rooted in the boiling controversies in the New Republic over what law and judges were supposed to do in this novus ordo seclorum, this new order in the ages. Before the Revolution, lawyers had more to do with supervising community morals, determining tax assessments, and issuing licenses, appointing road commissioners, and the like. Judges had been crown appointees, settling disputes through the invocation of English common law and its great interpreter, Sir William Blackstone, and, on the strength of the celebrated William Murray, the first Earl of Mansfield, strictly limiting the discretion of juries. The Revolution, however, was nowhere more revolutionary than its overthrow of these practices. Common law, which was little more than the accumulated precedents set by English courts, was now anathema to the new American order. Blackstone, whose whole theory of law was based on the sovereignty of the monarch and the glories of Parliament, was rejected as a holdover of Toryism. Lord Mansfield, as much for his landmark anti-slavery decision in the Somerset case of 1770, as for his notions about the power of judges and the integrity of commercial contract, became an object of infamy. Nathaniel Chipman's Sketches of the Principles of Popular Government attacked Blackstone's ideas on sovereignty as wholly inadmissible in a democratic republic. Every dictate of Enlightenment reason and every respect for America as a republic demanded, or seemed to demand, a completely new kind of jurisprudence for Americans. A jurisprudence free from all-powerful judges, deferential to the right of juries to interpret the law for themselves, and based entirely on clearly written statutes adopted by the legislatures as the voice of the people, where real sovereignty resided. The principal difficulty with this overthrow of common law was that it was easier said than done. An entirely new Republican jurisprudence could not be invented whole cloth by even the most diligent state legislature, and none of them were going to tolerate the federal government doing it. Moreover, Federalists like Alexander Addison suspected that Jeffersonian Republicans had other motives in throwing out the common law baby with the monarchical bathwater. The common law is founded on the law of nature and the revelation of God to which all men are subject, Addison wrote in 1800. And though the Declaration of Independence annulled the power of Britain over the colonies, the colonies carried with them all the common law of England in their everyday operations. And Hamilton took this one step further in Federalist No. 78 by casting the courts in the role of restrainers of state legislative foolishness. The courts, Hamilton wrote, were designed to be an intermediate body between the people and the legislature, in order, among other things, to keep the latter within the limits assigned to their authority. The Jeffersonians feared both the extension of common law and the authority of judges in using it. Of all the doctrines which have ever been broached by the federal government, Jefferson asserted in 1799, the novel one of the common law being in force and cognizable as an existing law in their courts is to me the most formidable. It would make the Constitution, on this hypothesis, a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please. And this became all the more urgent because the Constitution was never more vague than in describing where the line between state judicial authority and federal judicial authority lay. In one of John Jay's cases, Chisholm versus Georgia in 1793, Jay unwisely declared that the state of Georgia could be sued by citizens of other states. The state legislatures howled in protest over this. And in 1798, an 11th Amendment was added to the Constitution, preventing the federal judiciary from claiming authority in any suit in law against one of the United States by citizens of another state. But the Jeffersonians would not be able to go to the amendment pump every time an aggressive Chief Justice tried to clip the state's wings. And John Marshall was nothing, if not aggressive. Although Marshall was far from being a legal theorist on the order of, say, James Wilson, he had seen enough of the shenanigans of state legislatures to have no hesitation and using the federal judiciary to save the republic from Jacobin republicanism. Never mind Blackstone's dubious praise of parliament and monarchy, this veteran of the Continental Army would devise a national judicial sovereignty to match the national constitutional sovereignty envisioned by Madison and the national economic sovereignty proposed by Hamilton. Just how aggressive he would be in this regard became apparent in the Marshall Court's first major decision, Marbury versus Madison. Thomas Jefferson liked to relate years later how, after his inauguration on March 4, 1801, he had found, lying on the table of the Department of State, a pile of John Adams' last-minute appointment letters for some federal justices of the peace for Alexandria. Although the appointment letters had been signed and sealed, they had not yet been delivered. And reasoning that delivery is one of the essentials to the validity of a deed, Jefferson forbade their delivery. One of these JPs, William Marbury, a Federalist who lived across the Potomac from Alexandria in Georgetown, filed suit on December 21, 1801, directly in the U.S. Supreme Court, requesting a writ of mandamus, an order to correct an oversight, and thus force delivery of his commission. Marshall handed down his response for a unanimous court on February 24, 1803. It was a gem of judicial tightwalking. Marbury's suit was technically invalid, but this was only because the Supreme Court is an appellate jurisdiction. Marbury, in other words, had filed at the wrong court level. But as for the nub of the suit, that Marbury had been entitled to an appointment which the Jefferson administration had wrongly denied him, Marshall was entirely in agreement with Marbury. And having this legal right to the office, he has a consequent right to the commission, a refusal to deliver which is a plain violation of that right for which the laws of the country afford him a remedy. Marshall thus, with one hand, established the principle that the federal courts have review power over both the actions of the presidency and the Congress, and with the other, removed any incentive for Jeffersonian Republicans in Congress to attempt further tinkering with the Constitution, because it really was an invalid suit. Marshall's next step was to bring the state courts firmly to heel. The Reverend Denny Martin was the heir of the Fairfax family, whose massive holdings on the northern neck of Virginia had been confiscated by the state of Virginia from Lord Thomas Fairfax in 1777, and portions sold to a land speculator, David Hunter, in 1789, who in turn moved to eject Martin's tenants. Martin himself had never actually set foot in America. Since both the Treaty of Paris and the Jay Treaty of 1794 required an end to confiscations of Loyalist property, Martin won the first round of his suit in the Virginia District Court in 1794, and in 1796 received an out-of-court settlement with an investors' consortium, which included John Marshall. And the consortium purchased title to Martin's property. But Spencer Roane, Patrick Henry's son-in-law and the most ardent Jeffersonian judge on the Virginia Court of Appeals, was determined to make the case a test of federal judicial authority. Roane insisted that the Fairfax properties did not fall under the treaty protections. And assuming that a state court had the authority to review federal treaties, reversed the 1794 ruling and the out-of-court settlement. The consortium turned to the U.S. Supreme Court, which, in a decision delegated by Marshall to Joseph Story, overturned the Virginia decision. But Spencer Roane, undaunted, refused to recognize the validity of the U.S. Supreme Court's jurisdiction in a state matter. And so one more time, the case went back to the Supreme Court as Martin versus Hunter's lessee, even though by this time Martin was dead and Hunter had sold out. This time, Story, acting largely as Marshall's mouthpiece, delivered a decisive slap to state judicial authority. It has been argued that such an appellate jurisdiction over state courts is inconsistent with the genius of our governments and the spirit of the Constitution, Story wrote. We cannot yield to the force of this reasoning. It is a mistake to think that the Constitution was not designed to operate upon the states. To the contrary, the courts of the United States can, without question, revise the proceedings of the executive and legislative authorities of the states, and if they are found to be contrary to the Constitution, may declare them to be of no legal validity. If Virginia and Virginia's courts possess the power to nullify the provisions of treaties, then there would be no hindrance to nullifying acts of Congress. And the Constitution would collapse like a deflated balloon. Once again, the Marshall Court had placed the authority of the federal government, and you might say the ghost of Alexander Hamilton, over that of any of their rivals or critics. But in no case did Marshall come more decisively to the defense of Hamilton's agenda than in McCulloch versus Maryland. Since that case offered a direct and unambiguous challenge to Hamilton's creation, the Bank of the United States, and the power of the federal government to have established it in the first place as an exercise of the Constitution's necessary and proper clause. In 1816, the Bank of the United States, which operated branches in 9 American cities, opened a branch in Baltimore without bothering to apply to the Maryland legislature for a corporate charter. As a federal entity, there seemed to be no reason for the Bank of the United States to need a state charter. But the Maryland legislature, teeming with Jeffersonians, thought otherwise. On February 18, 1818, the Maryland General Assembly passed a bill to limit the issuance of the bank's paper notes to no bills other than $5, $10, $20, $50, $100, $500, and $1,000. and to have a Maryland revenue stamp fixed to each, as though the state of Maryland could exercise authority over a federal entity. The chief cashier of the bank's Baltimore branch, James William McCullough, refused to purchase the stamps and was promptly sued by the state of Maryland. McCullough, in turn, appealed to the federal courts, and Marshall began hearing the case on February 22, 1819, in the basement courtroom of the Capitol building, where the crowd of onlookers filled the room almost to the point of suffocation, and many were sent away for lack of room. It may have been the single greatest assembly of legal talent in one spot that American courts have ever seen. Not only Marshall and Joseph Story on the bench, but George Washington's nephew, Bushrod Washington, as well. And old Luther Martin, representing the state of Maryland, and William Wirt and Daniel Webster as counsel for McCullough and the bank. McCullough versus Maryland was argued for 9 days, Luther Martin piling an immense ramp of anti-federalist argument against the bank, and how the bank had exceeded the enumerated powers of the federal government under the Constitution. But Marshall, with equal skill, proceeded in his written decision to reduce all of Luther Martin's arguments to nitpicking. Of course, a bank of the United States is not specified in the Constitution. Of course, the federal government may establish one as an exercise of its necessary and proper authority. What did Luther Martin imagine the Constitution was? A set of municipal ordinances that had to specify 30-foot road setbacks, the width of sewer pipes, or the size of executive branch stationery? Enumerated powers were not like creating a municipal code. We must never forget that it is a constitution we are expounding, Marshall said, not a building code. He could not tell what was more perverse. Luther Martin insisting that every detail of the federal government's responsibilities as a government had to be spelled out in plain sight to satisfy the enumerated powers doctrine, or the Maryland General Assembly's refusal to read the words which the Constitution used to spell out the Constitution being the supreme law of the land. Marshall said, if the right of the states to tax the means employed by the general government be conceded, the declaration that the Constitution and the laws made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land is empty and unmeaning declamation. It is probably too much to say that what Hamilton had begun in his Treasury reports, John Marshall secured. But Jefferson thought so. Marbury versus Madison was a perversion of law. McCullough was an abomination. Let the reader consider, raged the arch Jeffersonian John Taylor of Caroline, whether the principal of the court is not capable, in theory, of arresting all the measures of the state governments and prostrating them at the foot of Congress. That would not, however, prevent the Jeffersonians from striking out, and especially striking out at one target that still was available for their anger, the one enemy which they believed stood behind them all, behind John Jay, behind Burr, behind Hamilton, behind Marshall. And that enemy was Great Britain.